The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'm going back to one of the stranger interviews that I've ever done on the show. This took place back in 2001. Let me give you a little background on how things have changed over the years. Back in the days when we used to have a lot of authors coming through Dayton, I was recording the shows as they were being broadcast live. I did the Book Nook at 2 o'clock on weekday afternoons following my Excursions music show. And a lot of times the authors were going to be doing a book signing that night in Dayton. So people could hear an interview and then say, I'm going to go to the bookstore tonight and meet this author. Well, now we record all of our shows in advance. Very few of them are in person. Almost all of them are on the telephone. And most of the interviews that I do are booked through publicists at publishing houses. The publicists will contact me. And we'll talk about the availability of such and such an author, and then we'll schedule something and arrange to do it by telephone these days. Back in the other days, in the old days, we did it a little bit differently. We would usually have them come into the station and record interviews. And occasionally, an author will book an interview themselves. Well, back in 2001, I was contacted by a guy named Andrew Jones. He was a wine expert. He had a book out called Wine Talk, a vintage collection of facts and legends for wine lovers. And I didn't know what to expect. He wasn't doing a book signing. He was just passing through the area. He showed up with this other guy, who he called Sir Julian Knight from the BBC. Andrew referred to himself as the Flying Wine Man. They walked into the studio, and they had this big bag full of bottles of wine. And they pulled them out and started popping the corks on them and pouring glasses of wine. And this was all live during the interview. And I was so shocked and astonished that I forgot to start recording the interview. And I only noticed after we'd had a couple of glasses of wine that I was not recording this thing, and they were making these great sound effects, which I did catch a few of them. Let's listen now to the Flying Wine Man, recorded back in 2001 on the best of the Book Nook.
She got to the situation, she decided it was time she was getting to her late 30s to cap it all by getting herself a champagne house. And she actually organized to be in a train compartment heading for Normandy for this man's private mansion in the same compartment as this owner of this champagne house. And she eyed him up and let's just say she went down to his chateau that night and all the rest is history. But within months he was dying and her family and his family was suing her for shares that had been transferred to her name. And there was an awful mess. The family sued her for 10 whole years in the courts before finally they packed in and realized they couldn't win. And to this day, as I understand it, some of the relatives still survive and are very pleased they didn't win because the champagne house has become so famous and so profitable that they've done extraordinarily well out of the bargain. But
Mr. Tattinger, I'm just kidding.
You're wrong guess, and I'm not going to give any other clues. But what happened was that he went, of course, eventually had to confront his own mother, and she said, pays that man off, get rid of him. And I was paid off, and that was that. And there was nothing I could do about it.
So you were bribed?
But no, I wasn't bribed. The contract had in it that they had editorial control. And okay. Their editorial control said, this book won't be completed. Simple as that.
So they bought your silence. So
they paid off the honor of the contract, which I'd never give anybody the opportunity to do again. So these things, little things happen. But, of course, by now I'd really got the bit between my teeth for history, and I began to think, well, you know, there's got to be a lot to be discovered. And something I've been working on for absolute years is the history of viticulture, of wine growing in the USA. Just going to give you a little drop of something to aid this story, because I get, Sir Julian hasn't been doing much. Let him walk round and deliver you this little glass. This is St. Francis Sonoma County Merlot. It's actually the 1998. Lovely, soft, supple, plummy wine. About $23, $24, you know, realistic price. And I always say to people, if you've been treated out to dinner by a host and you want to take along the perfect bottle to thrill them with, it'll really surprise them and stun them when they have it afterwards. So it'll do the job. But going back, this little history, and that's where the St. Francis actually comes in. Let's work it backwards. St. Francis comes from Sonoma. Sonoma was the 22nd and most northerly of all the Franciscan missions. Mm. And the patron saint of the Franciscan was St. Francis. Now, basically what happened was, under Father Junipero Serra, around 1770, so the Franciscans moved up from Baja California into ordinary California, which, of course, wasn't United States of America. It was part of Mexico still. And they didn't bring vine cuttings at all. They brought sacks, Hessian sacks of pits of seeds, and they planted the seeds in the ground. Well, the truth is, they didn't actually usually plant the seeds themselves. They taught Native Americans to do it for them, and the first vineyards in California were actually cultivated by Native Americans, and treated perfectly well, and it was very strange, I think, that the tradition, because that early work they did, was never followed by the Native Americans. I don't know why they didn't go off and say, hey, let's have a go ourselves. I believe somewhere there is one Native American winery, and I'm trying to find out where it is, but I just honestly don't know. But so as they moved their missions a day's march apart, they wanted wine for three reasons. They knew what had happened further south in Mexico since the early 1500s, and they knew what had happened since the days of our Lord in Europe and in Asia Minor. The monasteries and the church had planted vines because they wanted sacramental wine, because also they often couldn't trust the water supply. And thirdly, if there was a local community and they made any surplus, they could sell it off to help support their living. You know, we can go back to the Bible, the New Testament, first book of Timothy. And what does St. Paul write to Timothy? It's quite well known, and said, stop drinking water and take wine for the sake of your digestion. It was known that Timothy had a stomach ailment. They couldn't trust the water supplies, so it's probably getting worse and worse. But he knew, St. Paul knew, that the vine was nature's filter and gave you something that, unless you abused it, wouldn't make you ill.
Sometimes a stomach ailment will keep you from drinking that good wine, as you mentioned Napoleon in your book, Wine Talk.
Well, that's absolutely true. When Napoleon went on his last exile, going down to St. Helena, and he wasn't under handcuffs or lock and key, I mean, he was roaming around the ship. I'm trying to remember whether it was HMS Bellerophon or whether it was HMS Northumberland. I can't, honestly. But they got down to Madeira, and they were using Madeira as a stopping-off point to refresh their provisions and their water and some wines and so on. And Napoleon asked permission of the captain if he could actually buy a butt of, I think it was Malmsey Madeira, and he was given permission. He bought one from Cossart Gordon, I think it was 1793. He took it on the boat, went on the boat with him down to St. Helena. But Napoleon also had his own doctor, his own surgeon with him. And his stomach problems got so bad that the surgeon refused to let him drink any. And after he died 6 years later, they actually brought the barrel back. That's what a pipe is, about 550 litres approximately. Brought it back to Madeira when it was very craftily purchased by an opposition trader called Blandy, John Blandy, who blended it with lots of other Madeiras to make it stretch for years and years, and called it the Napoleonic Solera. So he got away with that. But I'll tell you a strange story. Only 3 weeks ago, I received an extraordinary lengthy letter being forwarded by the publishers of that book, Wine Talker, called Piatkus. And it was from, I have to say, I think slightly eccentric gentleman in England, telling me he'd still got one bottle of the 1793 original Cossart Gordon Malmsey, and if I'd care to come up, I could have at least a teaspoonful.
Oh, my.
And I haven't yet made it, to be honest. I've just been too busy. But going back to St. Francis, and going back to North America. Now, I was explaining how this wine was from the last mission, so it was I mean, after all, the last mission at Sonoma had St. Francis as his own patron saint, so it was understandable you got that name being used. But if you go all the way back with the Franciscans, and you go back all the way with them through Mexico to, I think, the earliest date we've been able to prove so far for them planting vines is about 1560. But you can go even earlier than that to find wine being produced down in Florida at St. Augustine, where a French sea captain called Jean Ribault and I think about 50 of his men picked wild grapes, and they made a Eucharistic wine, a sacramental wine, and apparently it was so terrible they never repeated the exercise. But where I think probably the first wine was ever drunk on North American soil was somewhere mysterious, somewhere around Nova Scotia, around about there, by Leif Erikson.
Vinland.
Mm-hmm. Leif Erikson, you know, a lot of people forget. They think he was a pagan. He wasn't. He was a practicing Christian. And he was sent by his father, Eric the Red, to evangelize the earliest Norse settlers who were in Greenland, who didn't know about the Christian faith. And so it was understandable that when he went, if he found grapes, and I'm not convinced he did find grapes, I think he may have found cranberries, but I'm sure he made a wine because they said to the next lot of settlers coming, you'll be able to have all the wine you want. And I'm sure if he did make a wine, he would have used it as a sacramental wine. And that's about 1,000 years ago, though we can't be totally specific.
In case you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Andrew Jones, the Flying Wine Man. He joins us from England, and he's brought along with him his colleague from the BBC, Sir Julian Knight. As you gentlemen know, we carry the BBC overnight service here on WYSO. We're delighted to be able to carry it. And I think one of your former colleagues is going to be here next week. She's a writer for the Irish Times, and I believe she's worked for BBC Television. Nuala O'Fallon will be here next week on the program. She wrote a memoir called Are You Somebody? It was a bestseller over in England.
I have to plead ignorance. I mean, that really is ignorance, isn't it?
Now, I see Sir Julian over here writing prodigious notes.
Yes, well, you see, this is something that maybe Mr. Ustinov, who is of far greater fame than I'll ever be, but Mr. Ustinov and I disagree. Maybe he's got a much better memory than me. But you see, I believe that when you are fortunate enough to be a guest on a radio station or television station, it's important that you hope to go back there again one day and not to come out with the same hackneyed stories.
Oh.
And so Sir Julian notes everything that I say. Now, if I came back in 7 or 8 years' time, if you were still here, of course, then, of course, maybe it wouldn't be stale. But if I came back only in 2 years' time with, say, the book, The Stories Behind the Labels, I don't want to use the same stories and people say, oh, heard that one before. And whereas I think Peter Ustinov is one of the greatest users of the anecdote on earth, he does tend to repeat them. And you hear him say, oh, come on, Peter, I've heard that one before.
Well, he is a raconteur. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we had his only interview in the United States, so we didn't have to worry about any duplication.
You are very privileged. Was he coming over working as a Russian translator or something?
He had a book, a novel that he wrote called Monsieur René.
Yeah.
And it's a series he does about this Swiss bumbling detective. And I got the book from his publisher. I called his publisher up and I said, is he available for interviews? And they said, no, he lives in Switzerland. You can't do any interviews with him. They called me the next day and they said, Sir Ustinov has just flown into New York City for a banquet. He will be at the Hotel Pierre just this afternoon. If you call him up, he'll do an interview. He's flying out tonight.
Gee.
There you had it.
Sense of timing. And a little luck.
You have a wonderful anecdote. You say it might be apocryphal in this book, Wine Talk, about a woman who used to go and buy a bottle of vintage port on a regular basis.
Well, I don't know if this is coincidence, but I had just poured for you a little drop of Taylor Fladgate late bottled vintage 1994. I'm going to tell you about not Taylor Fladgate's late bottled vintage, but I'm going to tell you about Taylor Fladgate vintage 1927. Now, I've had the privilege of tasting just about all the vintage years of port throughout the last century, throughout the 20th century. And 1927, which I have to say I haven't tasted of Taylor, I've tasted of Coburn's, but 1927, in my experience, was the greatest vintage that I've ever enjoyed. But Taylor 1927 is generally written up by the wine writers who were old enough or go back far enough to have been able to appreciate it, because by now it's a little bit past its best, has generally been recognised as the greatest single vintage port ever made, if you can justify such a claim, but it must be pretty well up there. And there is this story, which was told to me secondhand, but I know the source, and it was of this little old lady who used to go into one rather elite wine shop on the old Brompton Road in West London, not far from Harrods, so people get some idea where it is. And she'd go in and she'd turn up about every 3 months. And she'd say, can I have a bottle of the Taylor's 1927 vintage port, please? The assistant would say, thank you, madam, and that's £80, £90, £100, whatever it was at the time. And she'd come back another 3 months later and repeat the exercise, and 6 months later, and after 3 years, the inevitable happened. She turned up there one day, and when she asked for the Taylor's 1927 vintage port, please, very sorry, madam, but it's all gone. What do you mean it's gone? It can't have gone. My plants, what are my garden plants going to do? Your garden plants, madam? Yes, my garden plants. I am the champion indoor gardener for the whole of the west of London, and I always use Taylor's 27. Actually, what do you do with it, madam? Actually, what I do is I pour that sludge stuff in it on all the plants, and they really find it wonderful. What does madam do with the wine? Oh, I just pour that away. And she declined to have their 1934 instead.
That's a lovely story. And I did bring that up by design because I saw you were getting ready to...
Well, I just come from Taylor Fladgate. I've just been out there 2.5 weeks ago because for the book, The Stories Behind the Labels, I'm researching a very interesting story. And I'm not going to let it all out of the bag. But if any of your listeners have ever heard of anybody with a surname C-A-M-O, Camo, I'd love to hear from them. C-A-M-O. So far, I haven't found one in any telephone directory in the USA, and I'm searching everywhere I go.
Camo.
Yeah, the story is this. Joseph Camo was an American citizen, apparently a friend of James Monro. We don't know exactly how old he was. I suppose of the time I'm talking of, which is between 1807 and 1815, that he was middle-aged. But I'm only surmising that. Joseph Camo was the only American who was in Porto, in the city of Porto in northern Portugal, when the French, Napoleon's army, under two different leaders, invaded and occupied. And, of course, there's this great, great tradition of British-owned port houses. Apart from Taylor, Fladgate, there are people like Graham's and Coburn, some people call it Cockburn's, and War and Dow, and so they get Smith Woodhouse and so on. But all the Brits had to get out because they'd have been butchered by the French. They'd have just been killed. Because at that time, America still had the run over from the French alliance in connection with the Wars of Independence. So the French and the Americans are on pretty good standing. So the thinking was that maybe Mr. Camo would be able to help save some of Taylor's business. It wasn't actually called Taylor's in those days. It was going to be a few years before it would be. But it was the same basic business. And Mr. Camo had the ingenious idea of getting hold of enough ships and just putting all the barrels of Taylor's port onto them and shipping them out the way. Very, very simple. It was simple, but it didn't quite work because all of a sudden, as Marshal Soult and his army, the Napoleonic army, are heading towards the city of Porto and coming over land, so there's a great flooding of the river because of melted snows up in the Douro Valley. The river becomes unmanageable, so they can't load up and they have to wait. By the time it goes down, there's something on the river estuary called the sandbar in Porto. And that sandbar, gets a little bit volatile when there's flooding and got over big and really blocked up the estuary. And so they finished up with 3 ships full of all the barrels of port, and they couldn't get them out of the estuary, and there were the French coming. And Camo suddenly realised, hey, at the end of a rifle sight, nobody's going to know I'm an American rather than a Brit. So he decided to go as well, and he left for Lisbon in a hurry. But the French came, and of course they didn't have any ships. They were a land army, so they couldn't get, and they were the captains of these three ships, keeping their ships anchored well away from any land. And we're just researching this in a minute, a couple of visits by Portuguese people taking out, I think, a couple of French officers to look. By the time under Wellington, or the future Duke of Wellington, Wellesley, General Wellesley, by the time Wellesley had come in and got rid of the French, only 2.5 months had gone. And there were 1.5 pipes of port missing from one ship and 10 from another. So they hadn't lost too many out of about 700. But thanks to Mr. Joseph Camo, the American, they had saved the stocks of what's arguably the greatest port house. I went there to research and try and prove this. And I'm trying to find out where Joseph Camo came from. I suspect somewhere in Virginia. And I'm starting where James Monroe's birthplace, because if they were friends, possibly they were schoolboy friends or that sort of age friends, at least take things from there. But it's a donkey work job to try and find it. I've also found out that Mr. Camo died in Bordeaux in 1815. So could he have been at one time C-A-M-E-A-U-X? It's just possible, you know.
Maybe he was Albert Camus' relative.
No, I don't think so. But what's so intriguing is to have the privilege, as somebody who admittedly just an amateur historian who's become a sort of semi-professional wine historian, to be able to have the privilege of going through all the correspondence ledgers in copperplate of Taylor's from 1807 onwards. And when you read about, after all, live flesh and blood, writing back to the English partners of the company back in London saying, now hang on, guys, you know, we got Marshal Soult coming over the hill. He's only 7 leagues away. Don't try and push me on what I got to do. We're trying to get these ships away, but just be patient. And there was that sort of correspondence going on. Absolutely intriguing. But Taylor Fladgate make this lovely, lovely late bottle vintage pour, which is ready for drinking straight away. Basically, it means they bottle it after they've kept it in giant oak vats, about 4,000 gallons in size, so that there's not the oak influence, because you haven't got the lot of oak contact as you would with small barrels. And they just filter it, and they bottle it, and it's ready for drinking straight away. Look how glossy it looks. A beautiful, beautiful colour. And it's got this lovely plummy nose to it. Really.
Wonderful nose.
Oh, it's absolutely delicious. And the other thing I should explain is 1994 was a great, great vintage. It really is wonderful. And it even tells, not just an ordinary vintage port, but it even tells in late bottle vintage.
In case you've just tuned in, my guest is Andrew Jones, the Flying Wine Man. We're talking about his book, Wine Talk, A Vintage Collection of Facts and Legends for Wine Lovers, as well as a lot of other things, including his online wine information. I see you have brought yourself a Fonseca as well.
Well, you know, people who read wineontheweb.com, if they go to the news section, will have seen in the last few weeks a disastrous story from Oporto, from Fonseca, a landslide from an adjacent property, completely demolished two stone cellars, two lodges, and has absolutely meant the ruination of about 900,000 bottles of port, or the equivalent of.
Oh,
great
my.
Tragedy, with some of it 20 or more years old. But I've brought you, I managed to save this one from the muck. This is a Fonseca 10-year-old tawny. Look at the difference in colour. This looks like iced tea.
It's much lighter, isn't it?
You know, it's a bronze sort of colour. And its nose is quite different. It's not plums, it's hazelnuts and toffee. It's really most, most complex. But the poor old Fonseca people, they're really getting in the teeth. Because not only just having had the landslide, but of course when that happens, in a suburb of Porto that's known as Vila Nova de Gaia, in other words, the new town of Gaius, originally Roman. So, of course, all the archaeologists suddenly arrive and say, hang on, before you do anything, oh, look at this, we've just found a Roman wall. That's got to be saved. And then, hey, that arch has suddenly been revealed. Now, that's from an Iberian palace. No, you can't move anything. And they've been stuck there now for the best part of a month, not being able to get on with doing any repairs or taking any precautions or so on. So
it's like trying to build a subway in Rome.
Yeah, it's the same sort of pattern, same sort of pattern. And, you know, one can understand it to some degree, but there are an awful lot of Roman walls in Vila Nova de Gaia and Porto, awful lot of them. But, you know, coming back to this Fonseca 10-year-old tawny, that's what we call it in England. Notice it doesn't say it on this export label for America, it just says 10-year-old Porto. Now, it's always important, if it's got the letter O on the end, it comes from the city of Porto. Notice sometimes I accidentally call it Oporto, which is what the British call it. It, technically speaking, it is Porto. And it's meant to tell people it doesn't come from New York State by having the O on the end. But it then says matured in wood. Now, that means in small oak barrels, you heard me use the name pipe, and that's what they are, pipes. They're about 530 to 550 litres in size. And so, of course, you get so much more contact of the port wine with the wood. So over a 10-year period, when you put the new Fonseca port in, it's really deep purple in colour. It changes gradually to a ruby colour. And over the 10 years, it changes to this tawny or bronze colour, or as I say, a little bit like iced tea looks. And I don't know why I say iced tea, it's just tea, isn't it? But it also changes because you get so much of the wine in contact with the wood and, of course, with the pores in the wood. So you get the breathing effect, and this changes the complexity and the character of it.
Well, I wish we had another hour, Andrew, because I know that we could fill it very quickly with anecdotes about wine and information. And your book, Wine Talk, I thought was a wonderful resource for people who know a lot about wine and for people who are just beginning, who go into a restaurant and are intimidated by a wine list, people who go into a wine shop and don't know where to start. You actually give advice on how to ask for wine and how to get helped and get something that you might enjoy. And I thought that that was very helpful.
And we do the same sort of thing on wineontheweb.com. And if you've got any queries, any listeners, about wine, you know, we always try to answer those queries. So come to wineontheweb.com, have a little look at it, do listen to those radio postcards, just dip in. There is so much to read, but go to the A to Z of wine reviews. They really are independent.
Thank you so much, Andrew Jones.
Thank you for having me, Vic.
That was the Flying Wine Man, Andrew Jones, talking about his book Wine Talk, a vintage collection of facts and legends for wine lovers, recorded in studio back in 2001 with lots of bottles of wine. And you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I went into Google and tried to find out whatever became of Andrew Jones and whatever became of his sidekick, Sir Julian Knight. And I couldn't find anything on Google other than some references to his books. The website he gave, wineontheweb.com, is apparently now defunct. He mentioned Peter Ustinov during that interview. I had interviewed him recently, and Peter owned a vineyard in Switzerland. He's no longer with us, but he did have one thing in common. When I interviewed Peter Ustinov, he started talking in funny dialects and accents, and I was so astonished by that that I, at that point, forgot to turn on the recording, just like I did for Andrew Jones when I was so stunned that they walked in here with a bunch of bottles of wine that I just I couldn't believe it. And I mentioned Nuala O'Fuilleann, the Irish writer, during that interview. They had never heard of her, and she is no longer with us either. Wow, it's amazing. Anyway, I try to look up Sir Julian Knight from the BBC. There is a Sir Julian Knight who's a member of Parliament, but he's the wrong guy. And I looked on Amazon to see if this book is still available, Wine Talk. They had three copies of it available, and the cheapest one was $120. So I can't find anything on Andrew Jones, on Sir Julian Knight. I can't find anything on Wine on the Web. It's all gone, just like the pop of a cork. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And this one's to your health. Skoll.